to the end and had to quit. So, Proverbs chapter 29, if you would. Turn your Bibles to that particular chapter that's going to serve as our introductory verse before we get to the actual text that we'll be sort of camped out in our instruction and our lesson this morning. So grateful for your presence. Again, we have so many who are our guests, and we are especially grateful that you have come and spent some of your time with us. Some of those folks are familiar faces, some not so familiar, but we're certainly grateful to have you with us. If I was to ask you this morning to define what it means to live well, I mean to really live well, what direction would your answer take? Maybe for some, your answer just on some kind of material thing or experience. A month-long trip to Europe, a home on the island of Maui, a big house, a large pool, and no mortgage. The newest model of an SUV or a portfolio that is filled to the brim. Or maybe your answer would take a direction that was more vocational. Maybe you would think, if I could just get that promotion or work, or if I had a job that I was doing what I loved to do. Or my answer would be more oriented in terms of relationships. If I had a fulfilling marriage, well-balanced kids, close friendships. But Jesus said in John 10 and verse 10 that the thief comes to steal and kill and destroy. I came that they might have life and might have it abundantly. What Jesus describes as part of his mission was to bring a quality of life to people. The kind of life that Jesus is talking about, however, is not confined to the other side of the grave. It's not the kind of life that merely encompasses the soul but offers little of anything else. And yet, in spite of Jesus' promise, though we claim to be followers of his, though we may be perhaps the best prepared for the next life, how many of us this morning are genuinely living life well? Proverbs chapter 29 and verse 18. Solomon writes, "Where there is no vision, the people are unrestrained, but happy is he who keeps the law." The King James Version renders that, "Where there is no vision, the people perish." And contrary to some interpretations of this verse, Solomon is not talking about goal setting. He's not describing some sort of church growth program. The word vision here is speaking of revelation. And what Solomon is saying is that without instruction from God, people are doomed to flesh out a miserable existence. And therefore, if we are going to succeed in life, if we're going to be genuinely prosperous, if we're truly going to live well and to experience the abundant life that Jesus says he came to bring, then there is a single source of information to which we must look. And so if we were to go to the Bible and try and determine our definition for living well, what we would find is that living well in this life, in preparation for the next, requires an essential ingredient that we know as wisdom. Over the years, wisdom has been defined by men in a variety of ways. Seeing life as it truly is, seeing ourselves as we truly are. The application of scriptural truth to life. The ability to see life in ourselves as God sees each one. But while there is a multitude of opinions in terms of how to define wisdom, for students of the Bible, there is one book in particular that comes to mind as a repository of this essential quality, and it is, in fact, the book that we know as Proverbs. Thousands of years ago, the wealthiest, the most powerful, the wisest man of his day and time compiled a collection of practical insights that provide instruction to its readers and thus provides them the means to live well. In this book and through the pen of Solomon, God supplies us with a treasure trove of information and advice that deals with almost every aspect of life. And yet there is a sense in which wisdom must be sought out. It must be dug for. It must be diligently pursued. Because while God's wisdom is available to everyone, it is only visible to those who put forth the effort, who avail themselves to its rich treasure. Where the book of Psalms is predominantly vertical in nature, that is, it deals with our relationship with God, the book of Proverbs is predominantly horizontal. And in that it deals with our relationship with other people, but also that it is much more about this life than it is the next. We've been reading through, or I hope you are a part of that, reading through the first nine chapters of Proverbs. As we've been reading through it, we get to chapter 8 this week. But in the first nine chapters of this book, we find several portrayals of wisdom. And by way of these portrayals, Solomon informs us that wisdom is not just some abstract concept, but it is instead a concrete reality. In fact, at times, he personifies wisdom. And he sketches her as though she is a woman. A woman who speaks the wisdom of God, and in so doing, she points us to the way to life. But Solomon's personification of wisdom does much more than just serve as a literary tool. It also helps him to convey the essential nature of biblical wisdom, that biblical wisdom is embodied and it is specifically designed for living. In fact, the truth of the matter is that nothing is genuinely known until it has been fleshed out in the everyday world. And so if you're reading through Proverbs this year, you remember back in chapter 1 in verses 20 through 33 that we saw the first portrait of Lady Wisdom, and there she is pictured as a town herald. She stands on the street corner. She makes her appeal in the public squares for people to respond to her call, to take stock of their foolish ways before it is too late. And in the chapters that follow from chapter 1, we see occasional glimpses of her. But when we come to Proverbs chapter 8, and I invite you to turn there. When you come to Proverbs chapter 8, we find what one writer described as almost a three-dimensional portrait of wisdom. It is a richly colored portrait in which the full beauty of wisdom is described in much greater detail than what we have seen in the previous sections. As was the case back in chapter 1, her appearance on the scene in chapter 1 is similar to that of chapter 8 in that it comes on the heels of a foolish invitation to live outside of the boundaries of God's way. A sinful solicitation that promises the good life and yet which in reality simply conceals a deadly trap. Back in chapter 1, the invitation came in the form of sinners who were intent on violence upon the innocent and robbing them of their wealth in order to enrich themselves. And it was there that the father instructed his son not to consent with such people because they ambushed their own lives. Chapter 1 and verse 18. Her appearance here in Proverbs chapter 8 is preceded by another foolish invitation, and this one comes from the adulteress, literally in the Hebrew, the strange woman, who lurks in the dark streets in search of a victim. And with her perverse lips and her false words, she looks to entice the young man. And as that chapter tells us, the young man is unaware that it will ultimately cost him his life. The structure of chapter 8 is very simple. It divides into five pieces. Verses 1 through 5 is an introduction. It's followed by the three main parts of the section, thus the three-dimensional part. And it closes with a promise of blessing, but also warning. A blessing to those who would find and listen to her, and a warning to those who would reject her. So let's begin, first of all, in verses 1 through 5, where Solomon tells us of her public stand. Verse 1, does not wisdom call and understanding lift up her voice? On top of the heights, beside the way, where the paths meet, she takes her stand. Beside the gates, at the opening to the city, at the entrance of the door, she cries out, "To you, O men, I call, and my voice to the sons of men. O naive ones, understand prudence, and O fools, understand wisdom."
She is likely being introduced here by the parental instructor that the last time we heard from him, it was back in chapter 7 and verse 24. Remember, no chapter breaks in the original. And so it is likely that it is the same parental instructor who is sort of introducing us. And he begins by telling us of her continuing call as she stands. And it is a call that is in stark contrast to the woman that we saw in the previous chapter. Unlike the strange woman of chapter 7 who lurks in the corners of the streets and the squares in the dark of night, wisdom, we are told, takes her stand and makes her call in broad daylight. She stands in some of the most prominent of public places. He names four specific ones. She takes her stand on the elevated locations above the streets. She takes her stand at the places where the paths meet, we think busy intersections. At the gates where things that were commercial, judicial, and social affairs transpired. At the entrance to the door, she cries out. The emphasis here is on wisdom's voice and call, that it is not just very public to the extent that it would be almost impossible to miss her. But that her call is also indiscriminate in that she strives to be heard by the greatest number of people as opposed to the strange woman in the previous chapter who simply set her sights on one. Clearly, wisdom takes her stand in the prominent places and she cries out to all who pass by because unlike the adulterous woman in the previous chapter who looks to avoid detection, this woman, wisdom, wants to be found. That's further emphasized in verses 4 and 5 as her voice goes out to the sons of men, literally the sons of Adam, all of humanity. And therefore things like race or class or social status or genders are not barriers that would in any way inhibit her call. But she's not looking just to obtain disciples from the educated and the learned, but she even reaches to those who are described as the naive ones, literally the simple ones, in hopes that they will be able to gain prudence. To the foolish ones, so that they would understand wisdom, literally that they would have a heart of understanding. And so in the first five verses, wisdom makes it clear that her listeners must not be passive in their approach to her, but instead very active in responding. Because when it comes to wisdom, we are either ignoring or we are learning. We are either gaining or we are losing. But what she has to offer is not just intellectual. It is preeminently moral. And we see that beginning in verse 6. In regard to her noble message. Listen, for I will speak noble things, and the opening of my lips will reveal right things. For my mouth will utter truth, and wickedness is an abomination to my lips. All the utterances of my mouth are in righteousness. There is nothing crooked or perverted in them. They are all straightforward to him who understands, and right to those who find knowledge. Take my instruction and not silver. And knowledge rather than choicest gold, for wisdom is better than jewels, and all the desirable things cannot compare to her. She begins her appeal, not by referencing the benefits that are brought to the listener. She will mention that, but not here. She begins, first of all, by declaring the quality and the value of her word. She has confidence in her message. She makes clear that what she speaks is what is right. In fact, 8 times in those verses, she commends something about the goodness of her words, the integrity of the message that she utters. That being in contrast to several that we have found prior to this point in time, the evil talk of the wicked back in chapter 1, the honey-dripping lips of the adulteress in chapter 5, the corrupt speech of the wicked also in chapter 5. What she speaks is noble, that is, it's worthy, it's honorable, it is upright, it is truthful, it is righteous or just. And those positive statements also clearly imply the absence of those qualities that would be the very opposite of those things. She adds a couple of other statements. That the wicked words are seen as an abomination to her, that there is nothing that is crooked or perverse about her speech. And not only does she recognize the quality of her words, but her speech is also said to be straightforward to those who understand. It is right to those who have found knowledge in verse 9. And because they are noble and true and right, we find in verses 10 and 11 that they are also precious and valuable. And here is a fourfold comparison between the teaching of wisdom and the treasures of the world. It begins with an imperative in verse 10. Take my instruction. This is a word of a command. Take this instruction over the choicest of silver, over the finest of gold. And the reason comes in verse 11. Make these choices because wisdom is better than jewels. In fact, wisdom is better than anything that a person could ever desire, that there is nothing that can compare with her. And yet, in spite of that reality, what we see fleshed around us and at times in us is that we settle for the silver and the gold. And wisdom, as valuable as she is, simply is perceived as being an optional side issue that we can take or leave. She then describes her valuable advantages beginning in verse 12. I, wisdom, dwell with prudence, and I find knowledge and discretion. The fear of the Lord is to hate evil, pride and arrogance and the evil way and the perverted mouth I hate. Counsel is mine and sound wisdom. I am understanding, power is mine. By me kings reign and rulers decree justice. By me princes rule and nobles, all who judge rightly. I love those who love me, and those who diligently seek me will find me. Riches and honor are with me, enduring wealth and righteousness. My fruit is better than gold, even pure gold, and my yield better than choicest silver. I walk in the way of righteousness and the paths of justice to endow those who love me with wealth that I may fill their treasuries. She begins by telling us that she shares a house with prudence, that she herself has found knowledge and discretion. All of those terms, by the way, come out of the introductory prologue in chapter 1 and verses 1 through 6. Before she goes into the advantages of pursuing her way, she again references that prologue, chapter 1 and verse 7, where we were told there that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Here we're told that the fear of the Lord is to hate evil. And she becomes rather in terms of the kinds of evil that she has in mind, pride and arrogance, the evil way, the perverted mouth. So here we find that our moral development is proportional to our cognitive development. That is, that the intellectual life and the moral life are inseparable in the fear of the Lord. That our knowledge that wisdom has in mind is not just a collection of facts. It's not just a collection of information, but it comes by way of participation and by action. Let me give you an example of this. When I grew up in Central Florida, my buddy and I, he had a boat, lived on the lake, and we skied a lot. I mean real ski, not this snow stuff. I'll catch something about that but probably later. It's too cold to snow ski. But when you water ski, it's nice and warm. That's what I like. You can watch a lot of videos. You can read a lot of books about how to water ski. You can have all kinds of information about water skiing. Doesn't mean you're going to pop up when the boat hits the throttle. Because there's some things you know by information. There are other things you learn by doing. And that's what wisdom is. It's not just knowing stuff. It's acting based on what you know. Responding to the information that has been provided by her. In verse 14, you'll notice that she lists four of her possessions that she is able to give to those who walk with her. Counsel, sound wisdom, understanding, even power, interestingly enough. And she says that she even gives it to those who rule so that they will be able to rule with justice. That her message, even though it goes out to all, it doesn't just go out to the commoner, it also goes out to the king, and it brings benefit to all who are involved. And while she hates evil in all of its manifestations, she loves. And yet you'll notice that her love is not arbitrary, it is reciprocal. Her love is given to all of those who love her. She promises additionally to be found by those who diligently seek her and to provide them with the good things that life has to offer to them. And yet understand that the rewards that she mentions here that include riches and honor, wealth and righteousness, the fruit that she describes as a gift that is more precious than gold, that is the result of counsel, that is more valuable than the choicest of silver. This is not some prosperity gospel that wisdom is preaching here. In fact, in verse 20, you'll notice that she claims to walk by the same paths that have been recommended by the parental instructor in previous chapters. And therefore, in essence, when you and I walk on the paths of righteousness and justice, we are walking alongside Lady Wisdom. And if we should choose gold or silver over wisdom, understand that you'll have those things, but you may only have them for a brief period of time. But you choose wisdom over those things, and Lady Wisdom says you will be prospered in the things that are truly wealthy, the treasuries that I look to give you when you walk in righteousness and justice. Now, in the next section, what Lady Wisdom does is she moves from the present time, when she is graciously generous to those who seek after her. And now she reflects on the past, in which she highlights her own origins before the day of creation, the dawn of creation. Verse 22. Here we find her prominent testimony. The Lord possessed me at the beginning of his way, before his works of old. From everlasting I was established, from the beginning, from the earliest times of the earth. When there were no depths, I was brought forth. When there were no springs abounding with water. Before the mountains were settled, before the hills I was brought forth. While he had not yet made the earth and the fields, nor the first dust of the world. When he established the heavens, I was there. Described a circle on the face of the deep. When he made firm the skies above. When the springs of the deep became fixed. When he set the boundary for the sea its boundary. So that the water would not transgress his command. When he marked out the foundations of the earth. Then I was beside him as a master workman. And I was his daily delight. Rejoicing always before him. Rejoicing in the world, his earth, and having my delight in the sons of men. The opening verse here, by the way, is the only one in the entire chapter that begins. It starts with the word Yahweh, and he is placed in the emphatic position here because he is the main actor in these verses. And in these verses, Lady Wisdom is simply content to say, I was there when God created. Here, Wisdom makes a claim to her listeners that she was a witness of God's great work when he made the heavens and the earth, when he set out the boundaries of the world, and thus she further establishes her credibility and it underscores her authority to speak on behalf of God. That because she was present, or she was possessed by the Lord at the beginning of his way and before his works, having been there established from everlasting, she not only knows how the world was put together, her point here is that she knows how the world works. And so she steps back to a time when there were no oceans, when there were no gushing springs, back to a time before there were mountains or hills or fields or even the first dust of the world. And she says, it was then that I was born. And therefore I was present when all of it was made. By means of every one of her statements, she is making a claim to her listeners, I was here first. She was already on the scene at the beginning, before God and anything else, and therefore she has access to knowledge that we don't have, and yet she is willing to share with us. In Job chapter 38 and verse 4, God is beginning to ask Job a series of several questions. And one of those questions is to Job, were you there when I laid the earth's foundation? Job would have to answer in the negative. Wisdom would answer in the affirmative. Yes, I was there. The only someone who was there when the world came about understands how it works and is able to claim a genuine knowledge. She's not claiming, by the way, here to be a co-creator of God. What she is saying is that her appearance and her presence in the world is unique, that it is very different from us. That she was there when he established the heavens, when he inscribed the circle, she was there. When he set firm the skies above, when the springs became fixed, when the sea had a boundary placed upon it, when the foundations of the earth were marked out, wisdom is saying, I was there. And just as we can relive the excitement of some great event in the past, so wisdom speaks in verse 30 and verse 31 with exuberance and exhilaration as she remembers having been God's associate and a witness of His amazing creative power. And this is not a reiteration of Genesis chapter 1. You'll notice that there are a lot of things that are not mentioned here. There's no mention of light, of plants, of creatures, land, or sea. Instead, the emphasis here is on God's handiwork in creating and especially ordering a stable physical environment, a place where all of life can not only dwell in safety, but thrive. Verses 27 through 29, we find there a series of when statements. Wisdom recalls a time following that when she was a workman at the Lord's side, when she was His daily delight. And she remembers the joy and the delight that she herself experienced in regard to the Lord's creation of the earth, but also, again, the sons of Adam. And due to her being a witness of God's creative actions in the past, she describes, or she possesses incredible clout and credibility that then allows her to issue what is the final plea in the chapter. And we are once again from the past, now back to the present. Verse 32. Now therefore, O sons, listen to me. For blessed are they who keep my ways. Heed instruction and be wise and do not neglect it. Blessed is the man who listens to me, watching daily at my gates, waiting at my doorposts. For he who finds me finds life and obtains favor from the Lord. But he who sins against me injures himself. All those who hate me love death. As wisdom speaks once again, she does so very much like the parental instructors of the previous chapters. She issues a call for their attention, and she follows that with both charges and motivations. To those who keep her ways, they will be blessed. To those who heed rather than neglecting her instruction, those are the ones who are wise. The ones who listen, watching daily at the gates, who wait at her doorpost, they are the ones who are going to reap the benefits that she provides. There's an interesting change that has occurred from the beginning of the chapter to the end of the chapter. At the beginning of the chapter, we saw wisdom going out going out to the entrance of the city at the doors and calling to her hearers. As the chapter closes, we find now those hearers are invited to come to her door and to listen. The motivations of verse 35 and verse 36 are both profound and powerful. That whoever finds her, she says, finds life. In Proverbs, by the way, wisdom and life are more closely related than any other concepts in the entire book. Because the ultimate objective of wisdom is life. And yet she even adds to that. She says, whoever finds her also finds the Lord's favor. And so this marvelous portrait ends not with some inspirational story, not with some encouraging metaphor, but you'll notice it ends with sober words of warning. But he who sins against me injures himself. All those who hate me love death. In contrast to the one who finds her is the one who sins. This is, if you have a marginal reference, it will have it misses her. And it's the idea of sin. If you've ever heard studies on sin, that one definition, one description of sin is missing the mark. That we're shooting at a target and we miss the mark. That's the idea of the word here. And so the one who misses the mark, they bring injury to themselves. But she doesn't close there. She also says that they demonstrate their hatred for her and simultaneously their love of death. And so tragically, many will miss out on genuinely living well because of what wisdom desires to offer to them that she makes available to all, and yet they reject her. Wisdom says, seek after me, you'll find prosperity and life and blessing. If you try and search for those things apart from me, the only thing that you'll find in the end is death. So the contents of this rich book is not just Solomon sharing some tidbits of life experience with us. It is instruction that comes in regard of the workings of the world from someone who was present when that world came into being and therefore best knows how it is to function. So let's go back to our opening question. If I were to ask you to define what it means to live well, genuinely live well, what direction would your answer take now? Because wisdom says that in order to do that, it will require the very thing that Solomon says this book provides in abundance. And that's wisdom. This morning as we close, just reference you to the wisdom of God revealed in the cross in 1 Corinthians chapter 1. Incredible wisdom there, but the world misses it, doesn't it? In fact, Paul says that the cross to the Jew is a stumbling block, to the Gentile is foolishness. The world can never imagine God going about redeeming people by way of killing his son on a cross. And in reality, that's not how we would have thought of it. But it is there that we see God's incredible wisdom and how he looks to redeem us and to bring us into his family by way of the sacrifice of his son. This morning, if you're not a Christian, we hope that you'll respond to God's wise plan to redeem you, to forgive you, to deliver you, and to bring you into his marvelous family. If we can help you to do that, make that need known. Why don't we stand and sing.